Welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show. I'm Joe Favorito, along with my co-host Tom Richardson. Tom?
What's up, Joe? Looking forward to this one.
And here we go again in 2017, believe it or not.
Our first business podcast of the year. Really psyched about it. Got a lot of good people to talk to, and we're going to get it off to a really good start today with an old pal from the business. So why don't you introduce Scott?
And I've got a trivia question for you. What do Executive Search and Bruce Springsteen have in common?
They involve Scott Carmichael?
Well, they do, but they can both be traced to Freehold, New Jersey, which is where Scott Carmichael, the CEO and founder of Prodigy Sports, currently lives, although we're going to talk a lot about his background and potential fights with NHL general managers and ball boys for the Showtime Lakers. But Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hey,
Tom,
Scott.
And Joe, thank you for having me.
Great to have you.
So obviously you guys have quite a history in various places, Tom having worked at the NHL.
Yeah, so Scott and I were colleagues in the late 90s, the National Hockey League. So I'm sure we'll make reference to that a few times during this conversation, but it's been great to stay in touch with you.
Some great alumni who have gone on to bigger and different and better things. But I started there in 95, but we can get to that, I guess, in a little bit.
Yeah, I was 98.
Okay,
So before we get to the past and kind of the future and talk a little bit about Search, because both of you guys are involved in Search, a lot of our listeners are students or potential students who are looking for jobs and may make mistakes, and you guys can kind of lead them into the right places as to what they should be doing and what the marketplace is. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Prodigy Sports, Scott, and how it got started and where it is now almost 10 years in, correct?
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
Wow,
almost 10 years
for Prodigy. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Nor did I until I started looking at the calendar and saw that we were officially incorporated in New Jersey in October 27th of 2007. Okay. Although, really, having left the NHL and gone over to ANC Sports and really kind of bridged into the entrepreneurial launch of Prodigy, which I began to do really kind of mid-2007, I was doing a search for the Dallas Cowboys in the summer, July of 2007, and ended up placing Chad Estes with the Cowboys and kind of got Prodigy off the ground. But, you know, it's funny. In fact, it was frankly Tom. I mean,
it's your fault.
I mean, a mutual friend of ours whom we used to work in the NHL, Glenn Herrine, and Tom and I were talking about Search, and it was really those discussions back in 06 and early 07 when I said, you know, that's a great...
Right, because I had been doing some independent search work as part of my consultancy, thought about a more formal search firm, which we chatted about speculatively at the time. And you actually did something with it.
And it's funny because people ask me all the time, how did you have this master plan? And I never thought I'd be entrepreneurial, never thought I was going to branch off and do my own thing. But thanks to, really, Tom, truly, I mean, I think back on it, I mean, it's ironic we're sitting here today talking about that it was
Scott's handing Tom a check right now. So,
right.
You know, and so...
I have a lifetime royalty deal with him.
It kind of morphed in between, fortunately, to have the Cowboys and a good friend of mine at the time, Greg McElroy, was there. And then Marty Greenspun from the Yankees, and we did a search with the Yankees. So it kind of took off from there, and it was just me for a while. Then it was my older son in between some stints he had, and then he moved to Orlando. Then it was my younger son. And now we're up to 7 and soon to be adding an 8th employee. And
that's terrific.
It's humbling. And like I say, 10th year coming up in October, which is really amazing that it's gone by that fast.
But it's probably fair to say that you couldn't have done it without the background that you've had in this business.
No question.
So let's use this moment to transition to that, because there are some colorful stories. Joe alluded to
them.
Let's
harken back to the LA Forum.
So how the heck did you start out in this business?
You know, it's funny. I love, you know, the opportunity, and I don't boast. I don't talk about it, but I was fortunate this 11-year-old kid living in a Los Angeles suburb, and my best friend, neighbor, said, hey, you want to be a ball boy for the Lakers?
And Who was it?
His name was Chris Murphy. Chris Murphy. His dad knew the trainer of the Lakers at the time. The ball boys always kind of fell at the time under the purview of the trainer. And so he had been at the year before and said, I said, Lakers.
Was that Gary Vitti at that point?
No, it was Frank O'Neill.
Okay.
Frank O'Neill. This was 1970.
Wow.
1970. I was 11 years old and I said, I guess. And one thing led to another, and that was the year the Lakers played. I came in. It might have been that same. I came in the year after the Knicks beat the Lakers.
I was going to say that was the big Knicks year.
And where Jerry West had a 63-footer, won one game to end the game, but it went to a seventh, and I think...
Willis. That was Willis walking on the court.
That's right. Willis walked, yep.
And that was like June of 70, right?
Yeah.
And so I my first year was the fall, 70-71 year. Elgin Baylor was retiring, and Jerry West and Will Chamberlain, and here I'm running around locker rooms and hearing stories and doing things as a young, impressionable 11, 12, 13-year-old, and I did it for 7 years.
Wow.
Were you like a legit NBA fan and hoops fan? Because you were a little nonchalant about getting that offer.
I wasn't
Those
at
kids
the time.
Probably would have jumped at it.
I wasn't at the time, okay. But became pretty popular in school where I'd bring in wristbands and, In fact, I had a big... big at the time. I never grew past it, but a size 11 shoe when I was in junior high school, and I'd be wearing Gail Goodrich's old sneakers.
Wow, Gail Goodrich.
Lucius Allen's old sneakers to school the next day. And so I was, humbling, but I was kind of the, big guy on campus. But loved sport, always wanted to play a sport, but never big enough, fast enough, good enough. So one thing led to another, and by the time I got to be a freshman in college, I said, I can't be doing this ball boy thing.
And you were at Loyola Marymount, correct?
Actually, my first year I went to Long Beach State, and
Jerry Tarkanian.
Yeah, and I was commuting for a year, and I said, this is silly, and I transferred to Loyola Marymount. Mm-hmm. So did my my final 3 years at Loyola as a communications major.
Were the Lakers practicing there at the time?
Yes. Yeah, they were. Very good. That's good. Mm-hmm. You're back to your Knicks
days
in 76.
You're like the Rain Man of college basketball.
Yep. And you were way before Hank. I mean, was Loyola Marymount good at that point in basketball?
No. They had was it McCluskey? Who was the they had a shooting forward, small shooting forward, McCluskey. But I left. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 82. Long time ago, if we think back on it.
Paul Westhead was way up. That was like 6 years
ago.
Yeah,
and so Westhead and Gathers and Bo Kimball came later in their run and gun years. But and I was fortunate, Joe, I was telling you about it a little earlier, just that the opportunity at the time, I was doing some Laker and King community relations stuff on a part-time basis and doing stuff for Pat Riley and Jerry West. And next thing you know, the Kings asked me if I'd want to be director of public relations. Now, think about that. So I'm a 21-year-old senior, first semester senior at Loyola when the Kings, it's just silly to think about it, threw a title and said, would you be director of PR for the Kings? I said, okay.
Wait, they were new to L.A., right?
No, they were there for
a
while.
They, Jerry, well, Jet and Cook, they were, they're in their 50th year, like the Flyers, and the second phase of six. And Cook started them in 67.
Oh.
Jerry Buss bought them in 79, 80.
Maybe that's what I was thinking, the changeover.
Yeah, so Jerry Buss had just been the owner, and so this is 1 year into Jerry Buss's ownership of both teams. Mm. And so here's this kid. Okay. So I changed my course schedule, took night courses, and had a mentor. I was mentioning to Joe a while back that the mentor who was the director of PR, who moved into the general manager's office and who I worked under, just died around Christmas.
His name was?
John Wolfe.
Okay.
And reflected back on the days back then when John Wolfe had moved to the general manager's office, and I was this kid, breaking into the business very young, first as a ball boy and then as a with the Kings. So
so the Kings at that point are Rogie Vachon and those guys, or are they?
No, it was
Marcel Dion.
Marcel Dion. I mean, if you follow hockey, you might remember the Triple Crown line with Dion
Taylor,
and Charlie Simmer. Very good, very good. And Tom shaking his head. It predates Tom's hockey years.
You know
years.
More about, right, I was going to say, I wasn't
Rogie,
paying this close
Rogie
attention.
Vachon was one of my heroes.
Yeah, Rogie later became the GM, of course, when I was there too. But Rogie had retired. Mario Lassard, people that no one would recognize now in terms of the team back then. And I was this young kid learning literally on the job of how to promote a sport of hockey in a market like Los Angeles. That, you look back on that and the phenomenal opportunities I had at such a young age with really a lot of it self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was self-taught, learning from people in the business, other PR directors around the league or with the Lakers. And
John Halligan, I'm sure, was one. Probably.
John Halligan was John and Janet right. Halligan both, who was terrific with the Rangers. In fact, I don't want to get into it. We don't know how much time, right. But I actually met my wife in New York in 1981, I traveled with the Kings to New York, and my wife, who was from Los Angeles, who worked for an airline, big hockey fan, came out. I met her at a bar, Charlie O's,
underneath
the garden.
Wow.
After a playoff game that night, called Janet Halligan the next day, and how brash was I? And I said, Janet Hamsaw, I met a couple girls last night. Can I get a couple tickets to the game? And I felt like such a floozy, you know, like such an idiot.
But it worked.
But yeah. It worked, and we got married, and we've been married 33 years now, and we lived 10 months. So anyway, too many stories to tell, but great stuff.
So we go through the ball boy. You're working with the Kings, and the Kings have a famous series against Wayne Gretzky and the Edmonton Oilers, and this goes to the story that we alluded to at the beginning. So tell us a little bit about kind of the altercation with Glenn Sather and what that was like as a public relations official working for the Los Angeles Kings.
Well, again, just telling the story recently to my son, who now at soon to be 26 is older than I was at the time. So I was a young 1982, and the Edmonton Oilers had a phenomenal breakout year. Gretzky set all kinds of phenomenal scoring records. I think this year he had 96 goals and 200 and something points. And so back in there, they played each other eight times in the division. I think it was eight times. So it was four home and four away. And so every time the Oilers came into town, everybody, all the local media wanted to talk to Gretzky. And it was at a time where I think nowadays PR people generally travel with the teams at all leagues and all levels, and didn't back then. So I'd always try and approach the team, and invariably the head coach at the time was Glenn Sather, and get Gretzky to be do interviews, and you know, it was always pulling teeth and very, very difficult. So I needless to say, didn't have a large love affair with Glenn Sather. So fast forward to the playoffs that year. Edmonton finished first overall, record year. The Kings, I think, finished 16th, and it was 1-16. And so first round playoff series, best of five, and the Kings win game one on the road, 10-8. You know,
wow,
great defensive hockey. lost game two. They go back to LA for game three. And for those of you who follow hockey, famously known as the Miracle on Manchester, where Edmonton was up 5-0 in game three in Los Angeles, and the players were literally on the bench laughing, and they were. They were a great team. Paul Coffey, Mark Messier, Wayne Gretzky, Jari Kurri, I mean, go on, Hall of Famers, Grant Fuhr, and they were laughing. Well, the Kings come back and score five goals in the third period to tie it.
Wow.
The owner had left. Jerry Bush had left the building when it was 5-0 and left. He was embarrassed. They go to overtime. The Kings win in overtime 6-5, and the building's going nuts. You'd think they had won the Stanley Cup. So as a young 22-year-old PR director, I run downstairs all, you know, exuberant that we won, and I opened the door to the locker room area, and I turn and I look down the hallway, and the Oilers are coming off the ice, and being an immature kid, I look back and now shake my head. I said something like, oh, you know, blankety blankety blank, screw you guys. So fast forward, there's a day off, and then game four back in Los Angeles again. So Edmonton wins the game, forcing a fifth and final game back in Edmonton. So going down the stairs to the locker room after that game, I open the door, and it's always right in front of the Oilers locker room, and Glenn Sather's there, walking with the team off the ice. And he says, you're not yapping tonight, are you, little prick?
Wow.
And I said something like, you know, a four-letter word that maybe I shouldn't say, and, you know, back at him, and he takes a swing at me, and the players are intervening with sticks in my face, and it became
a slap shot.
You know, so, and it was
see, even off the court in the NHL, they have fights.
And the
this
media
is really commonplace.
It was unfortunate. It was in front of a lot of media who were there to do the post game interviews, so wow. It became a little side story. And you know,
did anybody reprimand you?
No, as a matter of fact,
kept
no
promoted.
One. I got in the actually to the Kings locker room, and the enforcer on the team was a guy by the name of Jerry Korab, and Korab
sure.
came to me and said,
"King Kong Korab."
He goes, "What happened?" He goes, "You need any help? Let me go over there with you." So they were standing up for me, too. So anyway, it was...
You should have grabbed them and gone back out.
I Googled it the other day, and much to my surprise, I found a side... You know, there's some sidebars that were written about at the time. But my younger, immature days in sport...
That's fantastic. So how did you make your way to the NHL?
So I worked for the Kings. That was in the early 80s. Left and went to work for the LA Clippers. And
oh, that's
did,
right. Okay.
Did 2 years of penitentiary time with Don Sterling and the Clipper organization. And then went back to the Kings in 88, just a month after the trade for Gretzky. Gretzky had been traded and, you know, much talked about trade. And so I spent 88 to 95, great years with Gretzky and the Kings and Hollywood and all that. And then the NHL called and were launching a department to work on behalf of the teams and kind of call it Teambo, but it really was never Teambo. Yeah, right. But
who
so,
was leading that charge? Like, who made the call? Who was the hiring manager for that job?
Rick Dudley initially called.
Oh, wow. Okay,
yeah,
that's Rick, funny.
And then, Ed, you know, but I interviewed with Steve Solomon and came out and met with Steve and Gary and Gary Bettman. And I'll never forget, I was sitting in there and I lived in Los Angeles, literally half a block down from the big baseball complex. My son was playing Little League baseball, and you know, it was great. And I, you know, had the luxury of going. And I said, I never forget looking at Steve Solomon like it was yesterday. I said, you know, it's a big adjustment to move into the area, and I don't know much about the commute. And you know, I coach my kids' Little League softball baseball team, and he goes, oh no, don't worry, you'll still be able to do that. That's really important to us. Well, little did I, Tom's laughing, because little did I know that. Unless I was going to coach that team at midnight, or
Wow,
it didn't really happen. But but I never forget that pitch. And
but to be clear, they came after you.
Yes,
they recruited you. Well, that's flattering.
Correct. Yeah, it was. You know, fortunate for me, I had a good reputation around the league with my peers, and they were looking for somebody.
Maybe it was the Sather thing.
Yeah, well, I had some gumption. I don't know, but what was important, Tom, when we talked, you remember when we worked together, the league was, you know, having an advocate for the teams at the league office. And although there were times I think I probably fought more with the league people to try and protect the team interests, but it was really
kind of... But it was a new concept at the time.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah.
I know, like, when I was at the NFL prior to the NHL, the team marketing department was relatively small, relatively weak in terms of influence and power. And that has obviously shifted dramatically since our days.
Well, and I remember, you know... and. At my peak, I think we had maybe five in the department.
Right. And which is tiny when you think about it.
It's crazy. I mean, NBA today, I think in their Teambo group, has about 80.
Right.
Now, it's a different concept, and they're doing a lot of analytics and doing a lot of stuff on behalf of the teams. But it was, you know, it was interesting, and it was phenomenal. Don't get me wrong. That was the best move I could have ever made for my career, and really got me to where I am today based upon the relationships, right? I mean, I was a local guy in L.A. and really kind of met a lot of people, but it was coming to New York and traveling around the league with all the 26 teams, I think, at the time, and then 30, getting to know senior-level people. And you asked a question earlier. I mean, you know, the basis of the relationships that built was put me in a position where launching Prodigy Sports was really the foundation.
Right.
So we look back on that now. I told my wife, you know, let's go do it for 2 years. We didn't know anybody. Family's from Southern California. I said, we'll go for a couple of years. And it's been 21, almost 22 years now that I've been on the East Coast.
What are some of your more interesting memories from the NHL days, the league office days?
It's interesting, right? I mean, it evolved a little bit. I mean, you talked about...
Remember the club marketing meetings down in Florida?
Oh, man. You know,
when we were trying to sell the internet agenda to the clubs. You and I worked on that together.
That was
pretty hard.
It was really hard. The teams didn't want anybody in... And I think it still exists today.
Yeah.
Teams don't want someone from, you know, a New York or the league office to tell them how to operate their team locally.
Right.
And the challenge with the NHL, probably even now today... Less than the other sports is that large majority of their revenue comes locally. I mean, we're talking over 90%, 95%. And so they're saying, look, we're driving all of our revenue here locally, whether it's through rights and sponsorship and ticket sales and so forth. And you got people in New York telling us what to do, and we're going to take over your internet rights, and we're going to control this, that, and the other thing. It was a fight. It was always a fight, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to sell sponsorships through, and we're going to, you know, mandate a Gatorade deal that was only $60,000 per club when Montreal can sell it for $500,000, but St. Louis couldn't sell it for. So there were always those fights.
Were you on stage with me when I had to do the club marketing meeting to announce the new policies we had established?
I think
the internet guidelines meeting? When they were basically, metaphorically speaking, throwing tomatoes at us as we made these announcements?
Yeah, it was.
And everybody chased me and you back in the hallway to complain because they couldn't really complain too vocally in front of everybody. But everybody came to us after and said, you know, what's going on? Why are you doing this and why are you doing that? And you and I were like, I don't know, ask Gary Bettman.
Well, you know, Tom, you bring up a point. I'm not going to take too much time on it. But the problem, and I think it still exists at all leagues, at all levels today, is that the owners will sit in an owner's meeting.
Exactly.
And the commission will have an agenda, with all the respect in the world, and say, here's what we're going to do. And the owners are going, you know, they're not in the weeds. They're not listening and executing day to day. And so the owners will go, it's going to be how much revenue? Okay, yeah. All in favor. So then it gets, say, Tom, guess what? You and Scott need to execute that at the team level. And the teams are going, when did this get voted on? Yeah. Your owner voted it last week.
That was my default answer. I said, guys, you know, I'm not trying to be difficult, but this has already been discussed between the commissioner and your owner, or the group of owners, the board of governors, I should say.
Right.
So it's basically a fait accompli. You know, we're it's not really changeable. This is more of an FYI, not a question about these things.
Right.
So it was pretty controversial at the time. But you think about it, those were the early days of trying to figure out how you would wrestle this beast called digital media as a sports league,
NHL,
which has become
you,
way
Tom,
more complicated.
Well, you know, you're being humble. I mean, really, well, you led that. I mean, certainly Major League Baseball wasn't there, and you know, they've kind of led the forefront and been a lot of notoriety where they are today. But it was back in '98, you know, when you launched.
Yeah, we had
that.
IBM as a partner, if you recall.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I remember that. In fact, for a while, you remember Tom Hicks from Dallas, right? Because he had the interest in the Texas Rangers.
Yep.
As well as the Dallas
Thanks
Stars.
Thanks, Dallas Rodriguez.
Right. So there was talk for a while as we worked with Morgan Stanley quite closely on the IBM relationship, and they were also working with Tom. So there was talk, early preliminary talk, about trying to do something in conjunction with baseball.
Isn't
MLB, that is, which is pre-BAM.
Right.
And so when they actually announced the creation of Advanced Media, we were all like, whoa, that's a pretty big announcement for a league to actually invest in the business as opposed to just taking some checks, you know, from partners. Pretty heady times when you think about
difficult
it.
Difficult times.
So, when you finally got the chance to leave, I don't know if that's the right phrasing, got the chance to leave or decided to leave and do the next stage of your career, what really was the impetus? What was the moment?
And you had laughed, but it was we're headed into the what was the infamous lost season.
Right. Which is what year again?
That was 2004.
Right.
So, you know, fortunately I was at a point, I was at a VP level there, and there have been meetings, and, you know, there were many of us who had been guaranteed our jobs, you know, but very made it known that, you know, there's gonna be a lot of layoffs if that were to be happen. So I'd been there almost 10 years, and figured I'd kind of done what I needed to do, and I didn't want to sit around for a year if there'd be no hockey being played. So I really, as a bridge, I went to work at ANC Sports, a New York or Westchester County based company that is predominantly their core business is LED signage, and launched a consulting division to really kind of leverage the relationships I had built throughout the years and trying to grow that into the business. But, you know, that was a misfit. I mean, no disrespect to Jerry Cifarelli and others. It was, a time for me to kind of reflect back on what I could do. And that's where I was coming up to Westchester County a day a week and working down in Freehold, New Jersey, home of Bruce Springsteen, for the other 4 days, and really was beginning to build the thoughts about going off on my own. So, I did that for 3 years, but really was... I was working for ANC, but really kind of building what I was going
to
do next.
But there had to be a moment where you said, okay, I'm going to do this. And that's always a critical moment for an entrepreneur or a new business to be started.
Again, it's funny, Tom. I can't think of a seminal moment where I said, this is it. You know, this is what I'm going to do.
But you did have to decide to take the steps to actually
Don't get me wrong. Now, I was fortunate because what I was doing at the time, and Glenn Horine, our mutual friend and acquaintance, was at the Arena Football League.
Right.
And as part of the consulting division I created at ANC Sports, I was working on behalf of the AFL as a consultant on the team services side. So I was able to take what was that, a retainer from the AFL, and bring that over to Prodigy.
Okay.
And then Jerry Cifarelli at ANC said, look, we want to retain some of your expertise. So I had an AFL and an ANC retainer.
Nice.
Which gave me some foundation, right?
Which is the smart way to do it, if you're going to do it.
And so I was doing that, and really with the comfort that I had some steady income on a contract for. So, and that's clearly what made it an easier decision and less agita to think, okay, now I got to go out and find some clients.
So let's talk about clients. And you talked about some of your initial clients and the search business, and Tom having been involved with Convergence Sports and the search business as well. Why don't you guys talk a little bit about what exactly is a search business? Because when you mention, and I'm going to say the nasty word with the H, the headhunter business to people, either people love it or they go running for the hills. So
let me jump in with a point which reminds me of our conversation 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What I started to see as a guy that grew up in digital, you know, the transition from analog to digital in the media business and in the sports business, was that clearly the game changer, the rights were the rights were the rights, the marks are the marks are the marks. The game changer was going to be the human capital that you applied to that. And I saw this in two different leagues, And I had this kind of perspective, and I kept thinking that, you know, people really do make the difference. You know, how is Paul Tagliabue different than Gary Bettman? How is Rick Dudley different than Steve Solomon? I mean, all these interesting guys who are really smart with different styles, styles of leadership, styles of knowledge, or levels of knowledge about certain areas of the business, et cetera. So it seemed to me that the human capital portion of the game was actually one of the most important, if not the most important. So I kind of became fascinated with that. And I had a chance, after I started my business a little bit before Scott, Convergence, to just, even though it was primarily on, focused on consulting, to start doing some select search assignments, because I knew about hiring, I knew the issues and the trends, and I knew the people, like Scott. And then I started thinking about what I had experienced as a headhuntee, if that's a word, from all the big search firms.
Yes.
And you know what I'm going to
say.
They don't really know the industry. When I say the industry, I mean sports, because we all know, we've had the good fortune of working in it for a long time, it is a unique industry. So I'd get these calls through the years, and I realized these people are really nice, and typically they're very charming, but they don't really know the business. And then I'm thinking, well, I know the business, I try to be charming, and I know the issues, and I know a lot of the people, so that was kind of my view of things. And I figured I don't necessarily want to do it full-time based on other things I was doing, but I know enough to be dangerous.
Well, in a similar yet somewhat different, but I think you can draw the parallels here, is when I was at the league office for those nearly 10 years, mm-hmm. and in the role that I played as the, really kind of the consultant or the go-between for the teams, I'd often get calls from the team saying, hey, we're looking for, you know, mm-hmm. a VP of sponsorship or, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever the case may be. Or we'll be talking to the people and saying, hey, I'm looking to leave the Capitals and you know, want to take another role, et cetera, et cetera. So I was playing this de facto recruiter at a time when, you know, I was being paid by the National Hockey League. And so I began to apply some of those principles, or at least those conversations I had. But Tom, you couldn't agree more. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And you talk about culture, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but what I absolutely love about this business, and I'm absolutely passionate about it, and I can talk about it for days, was the putting together. You got a client, any given client, and the culture of any given organization runs rampant, right? You could be the Dallas Cowboys to the New Orleans Saints and Pelicans to the PGA Tour. You know, you go on down the list, and everybody, you know, has got different cultures within their organization. So you got to understand, as you well know, the what is the culture, what's the personality, what's needed to fit this, and then go out and find. Because there's dozens and dozens of people who have the right skill.
Right. The hard skills are easy to find.
Yes.
It's the soft skills.
And I love
and the match,
putting
yeah.
that together.
Right.
And, you know, and working with the Miami Dolphins right now, and Todd Klein, who's their chief commercial officer, great guy, great culture. And it changes. So Todd Klein's been there for 2 years, but it changed dramatically when he came on board. So even within the same organization, same owner, new CRO, now that changes. And so you have to understand that. That's the best part of it.
Right, and what we've witnessed with all our friends and acquaintances who have come and gone a different job is that the disconnect that basically ends relationships is typically cultural.
No question.
It's not, oh, the person doesn't know enough
that's
about
exactly
the topic.
Right.
Or, it's like getting married.
Or is not
really
working,
is.
It's, or
really
they're not
is.
Working hard enough or something like that. That's usually not it.
It really is.
It's usually like, you know, this guy's not a good match for this company at this moment in time.
And you try and do all that due diligence,
right?
You try and do all that vetting and understanding.
Part, right?
But, you know, when people are interviewing, they're not having around a casual conversation, a couple beers. They're, you know, buttoned up and they're a little, you know, and as they come on board and they evolve, people are going to settle in, and that's when the matches maybe disconnect.
Right. So, Scott, some of the work I'm doing here at Columbia involved is career coaching as well. One thing I urge all our students to look at really closely and study are job descriptions. So I want to ask your opinion of that, because I learned early on, the hard way, that unless you take job descriptions seriously, you have a tough time, right? So I think everybody should work on the front end, the creation of specs, really carefully, and then people looking should look and think really, really carefully, mm-hmm. yeah. and then you get much better alignment. So do you agree? Do you take the job specs as seriously
very
as I
serious.
Do?
Yeah, very serious, Tom.
Okay.
And we work very closely with the client. As much as they'll allow us to, in terms of crafting that,
right.
you know, and because to your point, what's on paper in black and white is literal, and so you know we'll often, you know, to the extent they'll allow us, you know, edit and critique and at least make some comments on the job description. On the other side of it, because I think a strong, what frustrates me, Tom, and you can, and I hope this will resonate with some of the students. I couldn't tell you the hundreds, if not thousands, of resumes we get that are so far off the match of what the job description says.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for saying that.
So read the job description and then look yourself in the mirror and say, okay, here's who I am, here's what my skill is, and I either match it, and boy, I'm going to want to apply, or I do not match it, and therefore don't send it in. Because we get delete, 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 delete. Now, I will say, we respond to everybody that applies.
Well,
unless,
it's good of you to do that. Yeah.
You know, and I have a part-timer who's home with their kids, and she does the database, and
right.
She'll send the notes out. We respond to everybody, with the exception of, I think the other day, I literally got a guy who's scooping ice cream applying for the director's sponsorship role with the Miami Dolphins. Those I don't respond to, with all due respect.
Right.
But read the job description and then be true to yourself and say, do I have those skills?
Yeah, no, I want to follow up on that because I did a small project this past summer where we had we were working with the CEO of this company. We had two specific points of emphasis in the job spec under qualifications. We decided to do a LinkedIn ad, and we got hundreds and hundreds of resumes back, and I would say 98% of them didn't have the first two points, which were the deal breakers. So one of the points I like to make to my advisees is follow the directions to start.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to do because you're going to save yourself time, you're going to save the other side time, and to the extent there are other opportunities in the organization, you'll have a better shot for a future
opportunity. By the way, real quick on that, look, I mean, as professionals, we're getting dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of resumes. We may not remember if one comes through that says Tom Richardson, and none of Tom Richardson's matched the skill set, but
right.
They might.
Right.
So if you come back around and say, Tom, you applied for a job a year ago here, and you
right.
had no, I mean, so
yeah.
Be careful. That's your brand.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Now we need an ice cream scooper. You're our guy.
So real quickly, how has the business evolved to where it is now? And then we like to ask everyone who comes on, where do you get your information from? Where are the places you go to every day to stay informed with the business, you know, whether it's sports or entertainment or media or what's going on in Freehold?
Well, where the business has evolved, as you mentioned, we're coming up on 10 years, and, you know, we're at a stage where we've got to take the next big step, you know, a staff of 7 and 8. You know, the goal for this year and future years is to be on everybody's consciousness at the senior most level when there's a president to be hired or there's a VP of a sponsor to be hired. Prodigy Sports has got to be in the consciousness, and so that's our goal moving forward. And I think we've done a great job. I think we developed a good brand, but we've got to take that next big step. And so that's the really big charge. As far as how we stay informed, you know, I do my best to read as much as I can, but it seems like every day there's a new newsletter out there and there's some type of new information. But, you know, the trade publications, you know, a lot of it's networking, Joe. A lot of it's spending time on the phone. Spend a lot of time on the phone every given day.
Keeping up these relationships.
Yeah, and it's, you know, trying to get into the city. One of my objectives is to get to the city more often. I'm only 40 miles south, and I got to get in here more and have cups of coffee and stay connected. But it's, you know, it's the relationships I built, my staff's built, and maintaining that. And you know, clearly it's LinkedIn, and clearly that's an extremely valuable tool in our business. Clearly it's our database and keeping it fresh. But it's, you know, it's talking with and networking as many people as you can and staying in touch with people.
Scott, I know most of the positions you work on are typically higher level, but the principles of good recruitment, I think, apply to all levels. So that said, can you give some advice to the younger people listening who are developing their careers or looking for their first big job in the business or looking for a great internship?
Use, and first thing that jumped in my head, it may not be
other than follow directions, which is my first.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that. You know, first thing that popped in my head, it may not be, you know, top or bottom on the list, but use your, here at Columbia University, you've got a phenomenal Lou Gehrig, you know, alumni base. I mean, obviously the gentleman's
he's not hiring.
He's not hiring.
Yeah.
But use your alumni. I was talking to somebody the other day who played baseball. And went to, I think, Binghamton, and he played in the Red Sox organization. Now he's 26 trying to come out. I said, have you looked at the Binghamton? Who do you know within your alumni group? Use your alumni. Use your university.
Yeah.
Before
you move on to that, from that one, this is a little simple hack that everybody can use. I've been given this out. I think Maurice knows this. If you want to see who's connected to the company you're looking at, go into LinkedIn, type in the name of the employer that interests you, do a comma, space, and then your school. And guess what? All the people who are associated with that company pop right up. So right now, for example, we have a lot of alumni from our program at Columbia working at the MBA. Yep. I just did this in a meeting recently. It's kind of stunning on the first two pages of returns. 90% of the people are associated with our program.
Think about it.
And boom, there's your target.
Where's your affinity? Outside of maybe growing up a Yankee fan or a Ranger fan or somebody in this marketplace, your affinities are tied invariably to the school, the college, and university you went to. So use it.
Of course.
And the other advice I give you is meet as many, and through that network, connect and network and meet as many, because that web gets wide and spun and goes in many different directions. Network as many people as you can, meet people, get in front of people, sell yourself, and you'd be surprised how quickly that will open up doors.
Yeah, and I think just I'd add to one point that I think is important is pay attention to the challenges and problems in the industry and help be part of, try to be part of the solution.
Yep.
And that's partly going to be based on your attitude, partly based on the hard skills you can develop, because some of the challenges which we've discussed throughout the history of this podcast are well known, and it's going to be the younger generation that's going to be solving these thorny problems that this industry is facing.
And you know what I found too, and probably less so here at a great institution like Columbia, but the communication skills of a lot of young people are so poor coming out of school, you know, who are afraid to pick up a phone and have a simple conversation on a phone. You know, hone your skills. You better be able to write. You better be able to talk. And it's so elementary, but yet so critically important.
Do you put a lot of stock into someone's thoroughness of profile, let's say on LinkedIn or Twitter? Like, let's say you're searching for a marketing or media job. If they're not active in terms of content creation, let's say on LinkedIn or Twitter, is that a negative these days?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. I'll give you a quick example. We were working with the Boston Bruins on a director of digital. In fact, I called you on that search at one point in time. Mm-hmm. And so understand that it's a digital role. It's a digital marketing role. And you're looking at LinkedIn. Don't you think someone who's in, it's like if you're a landscaper, shouldn't your house look really, really nice?
Thank you.
If you're a landscaper? So if you're a digital marketer, you LinkedIn, you should have all kinds of bells and whistles and examples on there who you are.
Right. Yeah.
And I found people that I just said, forget it.
Yeah.
Because they didn't
use
that.
They say they're digital, but clearly they're not really in actual practice. Right. So,
Scott Carmichael, CEO of Prodigy Sports. Most importantly, where can people find you and where can people find Prodigy Sports?
Thank you. Well, you can find me on LinkedIn. Having said that, my LinkedIn profile is probably not the best.
Right. So now that you've teed that up, you better go home and fix it.
Practice what I preach. But I'm available at scott@prodigysports.net from an email address. The website is prodigysports.net. And pretty clear to how to navigate through our website. And take a look and see what our history is, what we've done, and our job board, and we're happy to take any resumes.
So you do have a job board. So what level should people start thinking about you as a source?
We're generally director level and above. Okay. And in terms of experience, that's generally, you know, probably no less than 5 years experience, and generally probably 10 and more. But look, I'm a big believer that young, smart college graduates, postgraduates are going to grow to be the executives of companies. Mm-hmm. So we'll never shy away from talking to somebody. We have some people on our staff who will respond to every email we get, every resume we may get, looking for internships or otherwise, and we keep them in the database. And
I think it's fair to say that certain functional areas of the business, digital and social being two of them, and technology, are open to younger employees.
Yes.
Because the skills aren't necessarily there with the more senior people.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
All right, that was terrific, Scott. Thank you. We could keep talking for probably an hour or more, but we should wrap up. So on behalf of Columbia and Joe, thank you so much for
thank
your
you
time.
Sir.
Thank you for
my
your
pleasure.
Insights. Look forward to seeing the company grow to the level you'd like it to be at, and hopefully we'll get a chance to work together even more
thank
in the
you.
Future.
It's a privilege. Thanks so much.
Okay. And once again, this has been another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Joe Favorito along with Tom Richardson. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Joe. Have a good week. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson, and my co-host is Joe Favorito. And our production assistant this week is Columbia student Maurice Eisenman. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and other key platforms. You can also find it at blogtalkradio.com
thecusp.com/thecuspshow. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at @CU_SPS_sports. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.